Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. With us this week is New York State Assembly Member Deborah Glick, a Democrat and chair of the Committee on Environmental Conservation. She represents New York's 66th Assembly District in New York City. Welcome back to the Capital Connection, Assembly Member Deborah Glick.
Hi, David. It's very good to be with you again.
Yeah, and despite the fact that, you know, the budget was passed, there's still budget negotiations going on. Many New Yorkers may not realize that if they're not paying attention. And one of the big things on the list here is the environmental legislation. You've been right in the thick of this, and we see that this week the New York State Senate and the Assembly acted on some anti-climate change and environmental bills. The two houses voted on different measures, however, and lawmakers could not predict if any of the legislation will become law in 2024. Deborah Glick, help us understand what's happening here. Maybe we should start with the Climate Change Superfund bill.
The Senate has just passed that. We've had it in committee. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to put that out shortly so that it can get a full hearing from the entire body. It attempts to ask polluters, fossil fuel companies, to pay into a fund to mitigate the damage that has resulted from the use of fossil fuels. And let me just say that for those listeners, we know that some corporations that have products that are damaging either to our health or to the environment know about that damage years before the public does. And they, in some instances, like ExxonMobil, they very clearly worked to undermine climate science and to cast doubt on what was understood to be damage from fossil fuels. And I will say that the first discussion in government about the impact of CO2 occurred back in the Kennedy and Johnson administration, when scientists were first indicating that there seemed to be an issue. And so here we are, all these years later, and the result of climate change is plain for everyone to see: increased storms, more damaging storms, rising sea levels, melting ice caps. The clock is ticking, and we have to do something. And those who have created the problem, just as we asked the tobacco industry to pay for increased access to health information and smoking cessation, we need to ask the fossil fuel companies to step up.
Yeah, and I understand from what I've read and knowing the legislature after 35 years that the lobbyists from those industries work hard to kill that legislation. The issue for me is, and I think it will be throughout our entire discussion about what gets in the budget and what doesn't get in the budget, with Democratic supermajorities and Democrats more likely to support climate change legislation, why should any of these bills fail?
Well, the budget is passed. These are the end of session focus on bills. Now, there will be some who will say that, that particular bill is related to a budget item and therefore the budget is already done and we can't deal with it. But there certainly are opportunities to address significant policy initiatives, and that's what we're going to focus on for the next 4 or 5 weeks. And I think that what happens is, in some instances, there is a different perspective in each of the houses, and the houses have different ways of deliberating. The Senate has many fewer members in the majority, and their rules for getting things out of committee in terms of things bypassing committees is different than the assembly. And we have over 100. They have like 42 people. And so everybody has to have their say. Certainly, it's always been a personal frustration that we want everybody to have their input, but sometimes we talk ourselves into a corner. So I'm an optimist. I will say that we passed legislation regulating neonicotinoids last year. On some level, I was not confident that that bill would actually pass. But the legislation not only passed, but also we had some discussions with the governor. So it's not just the legislature. The governor weighs in. The governor's people send a signal that a certain legislation is not ready for their signature, for the signature of the governor. So we have to sometimes negotiate in advance of finalizing a bill that we can pass.
Do you feel the negotiations are always in good faith?
Well, you know, it's a delicate time of the year to try to suggest that that isn't always the case.
Right.
But obviously, I think what happens is that sometimes lobbyists make a case and the lobbyists may not be operating in good faith. They want to stop something. So from their point of view, their arguments may not be, in my humble opinion, accurate. And then you have to push back against misinformation. And then you have to convince others that the information that they're receiving is inaccurate and provide them with not just your perspective, but with the detailed analysis that demonstrates that that information is wrong. And that's part of the legislative process, push and pull and the tug from one side to the other. But I'm an optimist, and I think that we have gotten great things done in the last year. And I think that the budget around the environment, the governor had eliminated half of the Clean Water Infrastructure Act dollars, and we restored the full $500 million. There was an attempt to take bits and pieces out of the Environmental Protection Fund and sequester that for what we refer to as personal services. That would be really employment dollars. And we succeeded in pushing back on what we believed was draining away $25 million from the fund and restoring all of the items that had been nickel and dimed, you know, $3 million away from municipal parks and $3 million away from municipal recycling and so on. All of that got restored. And so I believe that in the end, we came out with a good budget for the environment. So the question is, was it in good faith? Ultimately, yes.
We're speaking with Assemblymember Deborah Glick. She's a Democrat and chair of the Committee on Environmental Conservation. Now let's move to the New York State Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. You acted on this bill in your house. It's something that New Yorkers are hearing about because of the idea that now we will make it illegal to have individually wrapped cheese slices.
Well, first of all, I would remind people that plastic is comprised of many different chemicals, some of which have toxic components, whether they are an endocrine disruptor or a reproductive toxicant. These are things that shouldn't be in our food. Now, the bill itself includes clearly that we do not override federal regulations. So some of this is scare tactics by the industry that doesn't want to do anything different. But I would also remind the listeners that plastics have only been around for the last 50 or 80 years. Cheese has been around for a very long time. And it is, I grew up and there was cheese that was in wax. There was cheese that was in wax paper. There was cheese that was in cheesecloth. So the notion that we can't break the addiction to plastic is wrong. And it is vital for the future of the planet that we finally break with the majority. There may be some applications that we can't, but it shouldn't be in our food, and it shouldn't be certainly the scare tactics about the individual lunch packaging for kids Consumer Reports just put out a report indicating that it had huge levels of salt, terrible for children, terrible for anyone, traces of cadmium and lead, again, not good for kids. And this was Consumer Reports. This was not the Democratic Assembly or an individual advocacy organization. This was Consumer Reports.
Haven't we seen also the medical community, science, looking at the amount of plastics in our bloodstream? It's around the world.
It is very concerning, and certainly we don't know the final outcome, but the reality is that these plastics are made up of, and other exposure that we have through personal care items, whether it's PFAS or plastic or whatever, we see people having health problems at younger ages, and it has to be environmental problems, that exposures that are impacting people's health. It's not just what was first microplastic, now it's nanoplastic, and that's what's in people's bloodstream. And we don't know the full impact of that, but we do know that plastic doesn't go away, and we know that the oceans are filled with plastic, and it's not recyclable. There are only a couple of, I think the number one and the number two plastic is recyclable. The rest of it is nonsense.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, as you said, the clock is ticking here, and we need to take measures in. It seems like the gap comes between the industries who want to sell these products and lawmakers and people who want them to innovate, basically, to choose climate-friendly ways of packaging, for example. And then you take, for example, the HEAT Act. So there's the utilities, and they don't necessarily want to put out more. They want to make more money. And that also didn't get through the assembly. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's been in the Energy Committee, so my detailed backstory is not perhaps the same as the chair of the committee might have or the sponsor of the bill. But I do think that it had a lot of support and it was very concerning. And I think that to some extent in the negotiations between the three partners, the three legs of the stool, while the governor had a small part of it in her budget, we were pressing, the Senate was pressing for the full HEAT Act, and it fell off the table. I don't know why. I think that it was concerns about in the end, not that I subscribe to what the concerns were, but I think that we had a lot of pressure, that it was going to hurt people, hurt jobs. You know, the governor's been very clear, things that have to do with affordability. Now, from my perspective, this was going to save people money, and it's why I am a co-sponsor. But in the end, I'm not sure why it didn't cross the finish line. It had broad support, but it was one of the things that when you're putting together a budget, sometimes even good things fall off the table. And this was one of those things that fell off the table.
Yeah. I hate it when that happens. Do you see any salvaging of this? Will we ever see a situation where most of our citizens can afford to heat their homes?
I absolutely believe that we are moving. You know, the problems with the environment were generated over the last several decades. We have many different areas in which we have to fix it. We see that we have given support for water infrastructure, which is crucial. There are lead service lines all over New York State. Those have to be eliminated. People need to have screening for forever chemicals, and those have to be expunged from our water supply. Obviously, I'm carrying the Packaging Reduction Act. It's being viewed by industry as something that will increase cost. It will help them reduce cost and incentivizes innovation. They will have to pay in because right now all of New York's taxpayers are paying to dispose of the excess packaging that is being produced. They should have some responsibility for that expense. And once they do, they will have an incentive to move to less packaging, less damaging packaging. There is an incentive for increased recycled material in their packaging, so we create a market for recycled material. And they pay less as they produce less excessive packaging, and they save money on not making excessive packaging. So we see it as, and it's over years, they reduce packaging. It takes over a decade for them to reduce their packaging by 50%. So they're given time. It does not even begin to hold them accountable for the first few years so that they have a chance to retool. So industry always screams that this is wrong, but it's the taxpayers who've been picking up the cost, and we have landfills that are at capacity, and those aren't healthy places, and it shouldn't be the burden of the government and therefore the people to pick up the freight for all of this excessive packaging. They'll just have to innovate, and we believe they have the capacity. They figured out how to make blister packs. They can figure out how to go back to something that is less damaging to the environment. So we know how to go back to basics, and that's what that bill does. And I'm confident that we're going to move forward on that this year.
By the way, those listeners who keep hearing emergency vehicle sirens in the background, I assure you Assemblymember Deborah Glick is fine. She's in no danger. She just happens to be in New York City. You just want to make sure people aren't worried about you at this point.
No, I apologize. We are on a main area in Union Square, and so we face two major thoroughfares, 14th Street and Broadway, and it just is the way it is.
It's the way it is. Let's turn to probably one of the most crucial issues the United States is facing, which is a housing crunch. And there was a housing deal in this budget. The issue here is that it's primarily for New York City and that upstate areas will have to opt in.
Well, I think some communities will opt in. We didn't get into this situation overnight. We had years of real estate speculation that drove up the cost of land, the cost of housing. And there is a debate in New York City, how did we get here? We have to build, build, build. Well, we have been building, but we've only been building luxury. And I will say that every discussion with developers on different projects, when you say, well, can we get some affordability in this? They always say, oh, the economics doesn't work. It doesn't matter if you give them an opportunity for a 10-story building or a 40-story building. It just seems like they can never make the economics work, even when it is city-owned land. So it is very discouraging. But we have done a number of things to create tax incentives for conversions from office space and hotel space to permanently affordable. 25% of those units that get a tax incentive will have to be at 80% of the AMI is the average median income, and then of that 25%, 5% would have to be at 60% of the average median income, so that you're reaching down to a truly affordable rate. Some would say that it has to go lower than that. We have added a lot of protections for tenants. Some of the reason people lose their housing is because there is a desire to push people out who have been long-term renters. That's what makes a stable neighborhood, a stable community, and that's their home. They may be renting, they don't own it, but that's their home, and they've been there for 20 years, and then a new owner comes in and says, I'm going to raise the rent by 50%. Obviously, there's nobody who could absorb that kind of increase from one year to the next. And so we've said, you know, you can't have usurious increases in rent. But you can certainly, if somebody is operating an illegal operation out of their apartment, if they're not paying their rent, if they're disruptive influences in the building, the landlord can take action. That has always been their ability, and we don't take that away, but we do say that you cannot make usurious increases, and that's the good cause eviction piece. So there are tenant protections. There are opportunities for the legalization of basement and cellar apartments. They've been sort of under the radar, and they need to be legalized in a way so that they meet health and safety code operations. And lots of people are living in them. We want to make that legal so that they are not at the whim of the landlord, or being driven out by the Department of Buildings that says you're in an illegal location.
Assemblymember Deborah Glick, I am looking here at the phrase book banning. And in 2024, you have introduced legislation to prohibit partisan book banning. In your wildest dreams, did you ever think, after becoming a legislator, that this is the kind of legislation you'd have to introduce?
No, and it's shocking that it's happening in New York, and it's happened in different places, and it's not just in rural communities. There have been attempts on Long Island. There have been attempts in parts of New York City where small numbers of parents decide that they don't like a particular book, even if they haven't read it. They don't like the title. They don't like the name of the author. So I just think that it is clear we need to set some standards and ensure that a small number of people who are quite organized and quite vocal but don't represent the majority, make a stink, as it were, and, you know, the library board gets nervous, the school district gets nervous, librarians have been under attack. Librarians are under attack. There are a lot of things I would not have imagined. Librarians being under attack is certainly one of them.
It's closer to Fahrenheit 451 than I ever want to get. Well, let's turn to another piece of legislation that hasn't gone through, but I believe I read is still being considered. That's medical aid in dying. Where are you on that legislation?
I fully support the right of people who are facing a terminal illness for whom they've run out of health care options. They're suffering, and they have a right to die with dignity. And I don't think there's anyone who hasn't been touched either by a friend or a family member who has gone through very, very painful and distressing health challenges. And while we have hospice, which helps people get palliative care, they may decide that they really don't want to linger for another month or two. And they should have the right to ease themselves out of this world. You know, I've had family members who I know would have made a different choice, friends who would have made a choice. I visited a friend some years ago who said, you know, I'm just sitting here waiting to die.
Yeah.
And that is not humane. We recognize that there are instances when our pets need to be assisted out of this world, and we should at least do the same for our friends and family members, give them the option to do so.
Finally, Assemblymember Deborah Glick, I want to address what has taken over many of the news headlines, not only in New York, but across the country on college campuses, as students who seem to be doing some critical thinking, I must say, and are out there expressing their ideas in protests, largely upset with what's happening in Palestine. Obviously, the Israel-Hamas war is happening, and that has created outrage on college campuses. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think it's a very complicated situation.
Absolutely.
Students have a right to protest, but they don't necessarily have the right to disrupt the operation of the university for other students who do not share the same commitment or interest. And I think on some of the campuses, the protests attracted people who were not part of the university community. And at a certain point, the university was hearing from students, family members, that they're paying for the same opportunity for their kids to get an education, and that that wasn't happening. Aside from the fact that in some places it wasn't purely peaceful, and obvious in New York City, and the damage in Hamilton Hall is significant. But I will also say that there's been damage in protests when months ago there was a march down Fifth Avenue, been in a lot of marches, been in civil disobedience. Sometimes you get arrested. You get an opportunity to choose whether you want to be arrested or not. You either leave. If you choose not to, you get arrested. But the defacement of the New York Public Library was inexplicable to me. And some of the students afterwards said to me, well, they can just power wash it. It's a historic building. They can't just power wash it. And why would they have to? That is not peaceful demonstration. So I have very strong feelings about kids having the right to demonstrate, but I also feel very sad for the students and the families who are not going to have a commencement on some of these campuses. They didn't get a high school graduation because of COVID, and some of them won't get a graduation now because of demonstrations that they might not have had a part in or any interest in. So the university has to try to make a safe space for everyone and still provide the education that the majority of students were seeking.
Well, it's never enough time. We've been speaking with Assemblymember Deborah Glick. She's a Democrat from Manhattan and is a person who will spend the time, who reaches out when she wants to say something. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that and hope that you'll just come back again when the time arises.
First of all, I'm a regular listener, so I appreciate the work that everybody at WAMC does. And I'm always grateful for the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Thank you so much.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.